books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show, recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and in today's show we're combining a thriller with a hidden disability in Chris Bridges' debut novel, Sick to Death. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On.
In Chris Bridges' debut novel, Sick to Death, meet Emma. Emma is sick. She can't work because of a neurological condition, so is stuck in her family's tiny council house. Emma is sick of being told to get over it. Her stepfather, her doctors, strangers, everyone has an opinion. Emma is sick of being the other woman. Her boyfriend Adam has got a great job and an amazing home. His wife Celeste is the problem. Emma is sick of being underestimated. All she needed was a target, and now she has Celeste. Emma is sick, just not in the way you thought. The audio version of Sick to Death is read by Georgie Wyatt, Karina Fernandez, Annie Adlington, and Helen Colby.
There was a point when I stopped really hearing the screaming in here. Like the nurses, I often don't notice it at all. My favourite cleaner is on today, and she's smiling to herself, humming as she works. One hand resting in her apron pocket, whilst the other slides a mop across the worn floor. "You're back again. I haven't seen you in a while." She winks at me and smiles. I manage not to shudder, remembering that time in the spring when I was here most weeks. I smile back as I lift my feet onto the trolley so she can reach the floor underneath. She blows me a kiss as she leaves. I sit back and take in the emergency department. The screaming has stopped now, but it's still the usual cacophony. A woman is shouting in a South London accent, demanding morphine. There's a repetitive moaning coming from somewhere distant, harmonising with the sound of nurses at the desk laughing about something, or maybe someone.
Sick to Death is a dark psychological suspense thriller. It's about a young woman called Emma, who's in her early 30s. She has a chronic neurological illness, and she is quite disenfranchised, so she can't work. She gets lots of attacks of illness where she's confined to the sofa, and she's living in a very unfortunate situation. She lives in quite a wealthy area, but she's stuck with her family in an overcrowded council house, which is one of the last remaining ones in the street that's not been bought up. But things start to look up when she meets a really good-looking, very pleasant, caring doctor called Adam. But it turns out Adam's not quite as perfect as he seems. He's actually got a wife, and Emma gets sucked into a plot to murder Adam's wife.
Overlaying all this is the constant beeping of machines. I breathe in deeply through my nose and out through my mouth like they've told me to, ignoring the sour tang that invades my nostrils. It's rotation week, so some of the doctors will be new. Unfamiliarity carries threat, but someone different might be good. I've been here so often that the faces of some of the staff are beginning to look strained, disapproving even. The nurse has taken my vital signs and an ECG. Vials of blood have been coaxed from my veins. My arm is a mess of cotton wool balls and tape, my chest sticky with electro pads. She looks at me over her mask. I've just realised it's Emma, isn't it? Jesus, it's been how long? I pretend not to know who she is. Looking away, I concentrate on a smear of dried blood on the wall. It's in the shape of a crow. It's Marie. Do you remember me? I didn't recognise you at first with short hair. It suits you. My hair has been cropped into something more manageable whilst I'm ill. What are you up to? I remember when we were training. You used to hang out with that other girl. I've been ill for quite a while. I've not been able to do much, really. She starts to say something back, but I speak over her. It's nice to see you, but do you mind if I rest? I'm not feeling great.
Now, she is sick, but she's also sick of being told to get over it.
Yeah, people don't believe her all the time. She's not treated very well, so her place in society is quite difficult. So she's just generally really quite sick of it all, to the point where she's kind of ripe for turning to crime.
She also has quite the obsession with birds.
She does. Her father was a very keen bird watcher. So that's her late father, who's now died. She's kind of picked up the mantle. So she kind of finds it's a way to while away her time. Unfortunately, she's got a little bit of a dark mind. So she kind of often thinks about the kind of dark side of avian life, because birds aren't actually as sweet and fluffy and cute as they always look. There's a lot of sort of savagery about them.
Now, Emma's invisible disability is somewhat inspired by yourself. You
Yeah.
had MS for 19 years without a diagnosis.
Yeah. So 2001, I had a problem where I had some numbness and kind of strange sensations in my left side. And I ended up eventually seeing a neurologist who sent me for an MRI scan of my head, which came back clear. So they just discharged me without any explanation. And I was having a lot of stressful life events at the time. So I kind of assumed it was all just like a stress reaction, and I kind of almost labeled myself as hysterical, really. But it kind of carried on. So over the years, I'd get these attacks. So I had another one, and then I think 4 years later, I went blind in my left eye and wasn't able to see at all. I just got peripheral vision only in my left eye. I think about 90% of it was gone, and it just came on overnight. And they sort of again said, "We think this is MS related. We think you've got optic neuritis." They said, "We'll just treat it by observation and hope that it comes back, but we need to do an MRI scan to exclude whether you've got MS." But again, the MRI of my brain came back showing that there's no scar tissue. So this kind of became a revolving door pattern. I mean, I was very lucky in that my eyesight came back completely within a few months, although it was quite a scary time. And then this kind of carried on for years. I'd just get these attacks, end up going back to see another neurologist, and I became very kind of blasé about it. Like, oh yeah, they're going to say I've got MS, and then they'll tell me I've not got MS. But obviously, it was having an effect on my life, because I'd get very profound fatigue, and I was trying to work full time as a nurse as well. And then eventually, in 2020, I had kind of a big attack where my left side went numb from my toes up to my rib cage. And then that was when they actually found on the MRI scan that I'd got scar tissue through my brain and spine, and they diagnosed MS and started me on a treatment, which I'm now on to try and prevent further damage. So yeah, it's been an interesting time, to say the least.
You said there you also worked in healthcare, so you've seen illness from both sides of the coin.
Yeah. And interest, that was an interesting sort of element, really, because when they first told me I might have MS when I was 30, my mind instantly flicked to kind of thinking about patients who I'd seen. And I think as a hospital-based nurse, I didn't really have any experience of what the spectrum of multiple sclerosis is, because it's quite a diverse illness. So people get different symptoms, and it's because it's the neurological system, the nervous system, it presents in so many different ways. So my instant thought was that I was going to end up kind of as someone who wasn't able to get out of bed, and that I'd need people to help me to wash and dress and those kind of things, because that was all I'd seen. Obviously, I hadn't seen this huge proportion of people who were able to walk around and healthily live a life and work even sometimes.
And you sort of started your writing, or your writing career was kick-started by a new writer's award.
So yeah, I kind of had an opposite COVID experience. So a lot of people recently started writing because they were furloughed. So people who'd always wanted to be writers and they suddenly had all this time at home during lockdown. I was the opposite. So lockdown came. I'd recently been diagnosed with MS, but was still managing to work as a nurse. So my work became very frenetic. But Radio 4 put a shout out asking people to write pieces about their experience of COVID. And I thought, I was working as a palliative care nurse, so with people often at the end of life. And I thought my experience of COVID was quite unique. So I wrote a piece for Radio 4, and in my head, thinking, I'm probably not a very good writer. They won't be interested in what someone like me has got to say. And then they got in touch with me within hours. And the next day, I was on Radio 4. There was a recording of me reading this piece that I'd written, and it went down really well. People were very complimentary about it. So I thought, I've always wanted to write a book. Let's try and do one. So rather than being that person who was stuck at home with lots of time, I was coming home from really busy shifts, exhausted, working during the pandemic, and then writing. And then what happened was there was an opportunity for a thing called the London Writers Award, which is an amazing initiative. And it's in recognition that often people like me with a a disability or people who are from diverse backgrounds, such as different people from different ethnic groups or people from working class groups or LGBTQ people, are very underrepresented in fiction, that those voices just aren't there. And it's a way to try and amplify it. So the London Writers Award put out a call for people who write a novel, and you had to just send in the first so many thousand words. And I actually got taken up on the award, which was then a 9-month program. And that helped me at that point. I think I was about halfway through the novel, and that helped me to work on completing the novel because we had lots of tuition and like feedback groups. So it was all quite a scary time reading work out to other writers and that kind of thing. But it was kind of very elevating and very helpful with the writing. It was great.
I close my eyes and listen as she leaves. I wait for a while, as I'm expected to, and the doctor walks in. He's not part of the new intake of medical staff, but is one of the ones I've seen before, a craggy older doctor in the public schoolboy uniform of striped shirt and chinos. He's brisk with words that feel scripted, firing sentences from behind his mask like he's a doctor from a TV drama. Emma Miller, date of birth, 12th of June, 1992. That's me. I hug my knees to my chest, bracing myself for the unfamiliar pressure of hands on my skin. This intrusive physical contact from strangers has become a routine. We go through the usual ritual and I tell him that my left arm and leg don't work properly, that I fall, faint even, sometimes, about the numb patches that plague parts of my body. As he's finishing off the neurological examination, a cardiac arrest bell sounds, a klaxon marking someone's likely death. He dashes out of the cubicle, barking at a passing nurse that I'm free to go home now.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And we'll have more from Chris Bridges later on in today's show. But for now, let's take our first trip to the RNIB library to find some new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. Putting the Rabbit in the Hat is the autobiography of actor Brian Cox. It was given to us by Quercus.
In 1996, I found myself seated next to the actor Nigel Hawthorne on a plane, and we got talking about our respective work. "I once did a film with Sylvester Stallone," he moaned at one point. Apropos of exactly what, I don't remember. "Oh, that's nothing," I told him. "Playing my ace. I can beat that. I've just done a film with Steven Seagal." "Oh," said Hawthorne, "really? What was that like? Do tell." "Well, Steven Seagal," I told Nigel, "is as ludicrous in real life as he appears on screen. He radiates a studied serenity, as though he's on a higher plane to the rest of us. Well, he's certainly on a different plane, no doubt about that. It's probably not a higher one. Seagal suffers from that Donald Trump syndrome of thinking himself far more capable and talented than he actually is, seemingly oblivious to the fact that an army of people are helping to prop up his delusion. Seagal would never do off-lines for others. Off-lines are when you do a scene and the camera's on your character while the other actor stands there to provide you with your feeds. It's a bit boring for the one off-camera, but most actors, the ones who aren't Steven Seagal, will do it because it's part of the job. But on The Glimmer Man, the director, a lovely man called John Gray, took me to one side and said, "The script supervisor will be doing your off-lines, I'm afraid. Stephen won't do them. Stephen doesn't do off-lines." "That's a relief," I said. "It would only be a distraction." One particular day, when Seagal was showing a girl around the set, he stopped by where I sat with the script in my hand. "You see," he purred serenely at the girl, "this is how a great actor works." "No, Stephen," I sighed. "I'm just learning my lines, that's all." The next thing I knew, he materialized mysteriously, keen as mustard, to do his off-lines for me. "But Stephen doesn't do off-lines," I thought. Confused, I glanced across to see John Gray shrugging, and I wondered if Stephen's attendance had anything to do with the girl he's been escorting round the set. Could it be a coincidence that she stood not far away? Action. We began the scene, but the problem was Stephen didn't know his lines. He kept fluffing them. "Stephen," I said, "it's very nice of you to do this, but it's not really necessary. Why don't you go back to your trailer?" Thankfully, Seagal agreed that his absence would make our hearts grow fonder, and there were audible sighs of relief as he left us to it. And that's what I told Nigel Hawthorne about my experience of working with Steven Seagal.
Growing up in Dundee, Scotland, Cox lost his father when he was just 8 years old and was brought up by his three elder sisters in the aftermath of his mother's nervous breakdowns and ultimate hospitalisation. After joining the Dundee Repertory Theatre at the age of 15, you can see the rest is history. But that is to overlook the enormous graft that has gone into the making of the legend we know today. This is a rags-to-riches life story like no other, a seminal autobiography that both captures Cox's distinctive voice and his very soul.
"Well, I can't do that sort of thing anymore," he shuddered. "I can't play a kind of action movie type part." "Ma, I don't feel that way," I told him. "To me, the nature of the actor's life is that we do the job. We do the best we can and we move on." I added that I had just read a book by Michael Powell, A Life in Movies, an autobiography about how he and Emmerich Pressburger became the preeminent filmmakers of their generation. In the book, Powell says something along the lines of, "In movies, there are no big parts or small parts. There are only long parts and short parts." He means that no matter what the part, it can be as big or as small, as slight or as impactful as the film or actor allows. It was a piece of wisdom that had stuck with me, and as someone who had decided their future lay as a supporting actor, it lit the way for me from that moment on. It freed me, in fact. It removed ego from the equation and allowed me to disregard the size of the role, the star wattage of my co-performers, even to a certain extent, the quality of the film I was in, and concentrate solely on what I was able to contribute to my character and what my character could contribute to the film. Actor, character, text. That's all it is. No doubt my words fell on deaf ears, because even though Hawthorne had put Demolition Man behind him and gone on to make The Madness of King George, as well as a brace of well-received Shakespeare adaptations, he was still fixated on that Stallone experience. That, too, is characteristically familiar to the actor, that feeling of deep-seated insecurity. All actors suffer from it. We're all desperately insecure. All of us, that is, except Steven Seagal.
Putting the Rabbit in the Hat by Brian Cox is read by Brian Cox and runs for 11 hours and 41 minutes.
We recently got best-selling thriller writers Alex Marwood's The Killer Next Door. It was donated by Hachette.
She wakes up with a stiff neck, slumped across her desk. The heating's gone off and her circulation has slowed, and the cold has woken her. If it hadn't, she'd probably have slept through until lunchtime. Wouldn't be the first time. She sits up, her head fogged and her mouth dry, checks her watch and sees that it's very nearly six. She's tired. She's always tired these days. Night work really only suits the very young, and Lisa's 34, no spring chicken in clubland. As of her last birthday, some of the girls who work here are literally young enough to be her daughter, and she's feeling it. She used to get through the cashing up by 4:30 on a Saturday morning, but tonight, even the quadruple espresso she took up to the office hasn't kept her awake.
Number 23 has a secret. In this gloomy, bedsit-riddled South London wreck, lorded over by a lecherous landlord, a horrifying collection quietly waits to be discovered. Yet all six residents have something to hide. Colette is on the run from her ex-husband. Cher is an underage children's home escapee. Lonely Dougal tries to make friends with his neighbours, while a gorgeous Iranian asylum seeker and a tag-wearing skinhead try to keep their heads down. But there for them all is Vesta, a woman who knows everything that goes on there, or thought she did. Then in the dead of night, a terrible accident pushes the six into an uneasy alliance. But one of them is a killer, expertly hiding their pastime, all the while closing in on their next victim.
She pushes herself up from the chair and stretches. At least she's finished. She remembers now, deciding that maybe she'd take 10 minutes just to close her eyes before she took the cash to the safe to try and ensure she wouldn't crash the car on the way home. I've got to leave this job, she thinks. I don't want to spend my night seeing men at their worst, all slavering with lust and googly-eyed from whatever they've been at in the toilets, and I'm too old for these hours. These hours and the stress and the worrying I might end up in jail. None of it adds up. It never does. She knows how many bottles of champagne are left in the cellar, and how many there would be if they'd sold them in the numbers the bar tabs add up to. It's the same every week. 200 people in the club on a good night, and though sometimes they're footballers or the modern robber barons of the city, slumming it among the tarts and the yobs, or silly young actors who think their stint in the soap they're in will last forever, £998 for a bottle of champagne is still steep enough to make them think about the choice between drink and dance, and most of them opt for a bottle of Absolute at £450 and a bunch of private dances at £50 plus tip a pop. But every Saturday, according to the bar tabs, they sell 100-150 bottles of fizz, and all of it paid for in cash. She slaps herself about the face a couple of times to try to wake herself up. Come on, Lisa. Sooner you get this finished, the sooner your day off begins. You can think about this when you've slept. Think about handing in your notice before there's police swarming all over this place.
The Killer Next Door by Alex Marwood is read by Imogen Church and runs for 12 hours and 7 minutes.
And we'll have two more brand new books later in the show.
And now a return to my chat with Chris Bridges and his book Sick to Death. The audio version is narrated by Georgie Wyatt, Karina Fernandez, Annie Adlington and Helen Colby.
The hospital entrance is flanked by smokers. A pale woman in her 20s smiles at me as I walk by her wheelchair. Her mother is standing behind her, resting a hand on her bony shoulder like she's guarding her. I'm about to cross over the road when a wave of vertigo floors me and I lurch forwards. My bag falls from my shoulder, spewing books and pills onto the tarmac. Hey, are you okay? There's a waft of citrus as a tall man in his mid-30s rushes over to me. He's dressed in a soft blue shirt with the sleeves rolled up to the elbows. They all do that for infection control. He's not a doctor I've ever met. He must be part of the new intake. I'd have remembered this man if I'd seen him before. His hair is an artful mess of dark waves over deep-set eyes, eyelashes like spider's legs. His features are film star handsome. I'm fine. I just felt dizzy. It happens to me sometimes. Do you need to sit down? I shake my head. I'm not sure I can say anything else yet. The pavement before me is only just righting itself. Here, let me pick these up for you. He squats at my feet and starts putting my books back into my bag. I reach forward to take the bag, and my hand accidentally skims his. It feels like an electric shock through my skin. Are you sure you're okay? You don't need to go back in and see someone? No, I'm fine. Honestly, I'll let you get back to your work. I walk away, hoping that he isn't watching my awkward gait as I make my way towards the hospital gates. It's an effort to walk up the hill to the station. People push by me on the pavement and I cower in towards the rust-addled railings of the hospital. My head spins with the constant motion of traffic, the searing noise of sirens. Once on the train, I pull out my medication bag and swallow a handful of pills dry, ignoring the stares of the man in a suit sitting next to me. There's a woman around my age sitting across from me with a young girl, both well-dressed, shining hair, falling beside glowing skin. The girl is reading, pausing to point out sections of her book to her mother, They smile and nod together, the mother pulling the girl into the curve of her body. She curls there as if designed to fit. I try not to look at them, but my gaze keeps returning.
Now, we'll get to the audiobook in a second, but the book has multiple narrators within the print copy. Are any of them reliable?
Oh, okay. That's the thing. I don't know if I've thought about that, actually. No. I think they're all quite unreliable narrators. I think they may be... it's a difficult one because I don't want to give away any spoilers.
Let's
say that
spoiler free.
Maybe there's issues of self-perception that are there. Issues of understanding. It's not necessarily that people lie, it's that they're kind of not telling the whole truth always.
Now, those multiple narrators, reliable or not, are reflected in the audiobook. The fact that the audiobook has four different narrators.
Yeah,
were
that's
responsible
right.
In the casting of those people?
At the very end point of it, Avon, the HarperCollins, the publishers, sort of put out the call and they did the casting, but they actually sent me clips of the actors for final approval. So I was able to listen to them and say if I thought there was an issue, but actually there wasn't one at all. All of the actors sounded perfect, and which was quite a surreal experience, like hearing the people that I've made up in mind finally speaking to me back in the words that I've written. It's really quite an odd experience. I can't describe it.
Now, the narrators are Karina Fernandez, Annie Adlington, Helen Colby and Georgie Wyatt, who listeners may remember as Georgie Morrell, who did an Edinburgh show about her sight loss, A Poke in the Eye. But Georgie is a narrator who has sight loss.
That's right. I was really excited to find out that it was somebody who understands chronic illness. He's got some idea of disability as well. I think that as a society, we've got this huge swathe of people, a large cohort of society, who are actually sick in some way, or they've got some kind of disability or impairment, and we just often pretend that they don't exist, or they're not thought about, kind of, and people it's kind of there under the surface, and which is kind of something that I've explored a bit in the novel as well. Mostly the novel is a story, but there's kind of issues that come out related to what's happening with the characters. So I was really excited to have Georgie. Yeah, she seems amazing and she sounds exactly right as well. I'd kind of heard of her through an article that she wrote in The Guardian when she was writing about her sight loss as well, which I thought was really interesting.
My stepfather isn't there when I arrive home. I can always tell when he's here from the moment I walk in the door. He emanates this musky smell from his aftershave. He's a 90s relic, red cheeks doused in designer fragrance. Mum and Becky will still be at work, and Ava at the school holiday club that she goes to. The settee welcomes me. My cat, Sparrow, jumps up and curls up against my legs, purring, and my hand touches the silk of her fur. I'm still half asleep when he comes in, but I sense him. His breath, the change in atmosphere. I feel the cat jump off my legs and hear her feet as she runs from the room. She avoids Peter and Winston, the wheezy bulldog who follows at his heels, drooling onto the carpet. Productive day again, then? His mouth forms a sneer. I know you're awake. There's no one else but us, Emma. I turn my face to the wall, hoping he'll go away, knowing he won't. Don't ignore me in my own house. We all bend over backwards for you, don't we? Tiptoeing around you in this bloody illness. It's not like it's even. I sit up, the blood rushing from my face, the room receding. But it's not, though, is it? It's not your house, Peter. It's my mum's, isn't it? Staring straight ahead, I concentrate on the gaps where my father's things should be. The books, his clock, the pictures of him, the negative spaces that scrape at me. They were all packed away within weeks of Peter moving in. He didn't do it all in one go, but moved them bit by bit. My father gradually eroded. The one remaining photo of me and my parents now pushed back, outranked by a larger one of Peter and Mum grinning on the registrar's office steps.
The hidden disability kind of makes Emma a bit invisible, but also makes people underestimate her.
Yeah, exactly. And that was part of my thinking. So for me, I've always been a really voracious reader. I read constantly and always have done. Sometimes I get through three, four books a week. So during bad times, it's always been a book to make me feel better. So kind of it's always been a thing. So like relationship breakup, work problems, life stress, anxiety. There's always something that I read that is relatable and I can think back to fiction and I kind of I think I've probably I'm a bit unusual in the amount that I read is so much that a kind of fiction is a huge thing for me. And it's like you've got somebody telling you their experience through a story. But I think with illness, I really struggled to find anything that I could relate to because I think the storylines about people's illnesses often don't encompass chronic illness. And I think there's a really strong reason for that. I think often if a character's ill, then often that has to be the only storyline in a story. That's how people treat it. So this person's ill. This is their story. They're an ill person. And I kind of wanted to take that and sort of say, this person's ill, but they've actually got another story as well. This person's ill, but they're really angry and they've been sucked into this situation where they're going to do A, which will result in B. And I think the classic kind of storyline for an ill character is that they have to have a resolution because that's how stories work. So stories start off with a situation, a sort of inciting incident, veer towards a climax, and then they move towards resolution. And with a sick person, that generally has to be that person gets better. That's the resolution. Or that person dies, and that's the resolution. There's a third option, which is that there's a surprise twist, and that person is a fate. But I thought, well, I'm not having any of that. I don't want Emma to die. I don't want her to get better, and nor do I want her to be a fake. So she's chronically ill, and chronic illness does not fit that trajectory, which is what my life isn't. That isn't my life. I'm not going to get better, and I'm not necessarily going to die. My life expectancy is not hugely different from people without multiple sclerosis.
You may have seen this in your time in healthcare, but sight loss is only one reason why people can't pick up a print book. Is it important to you that it's now available in an accessible format for everyone?
Absolutely, yeah, 100%. So many reasons. For some people, it's very difficult, isn't it, to turn pages, and there's obviously sight loss. I know for me, as a voracious reader, when I lost the vision in one eye, the first thing I thought was like, "How am I going to read books?" It wasn't, "How am I going to work?" or "How am I going to kind of get around?" It's just because reading books is such a central part of my life and has been since childhood. I mean, I can remember we went on a holiday shortly after it happened, and we were over in Spain, and I was reading. As I always did, I took about five or six novels in the suitcase, and I was having to clamp a hand over one eye and kind of try and read. I was like, oh, thank God I can just about kind of manage this, but it was a cumbersome process. So, I think back then, I think if I'd got audiobooks, I would have been much happier and I could have got through the holiday much more easily and probably had a lighter suitcase as well. Maybe taken more clothes, which I used to skimp on, take books instead.
Now, there are four female narrators in this book for the four main characters. If one of them was male, do you think you would have fancied doing the voice yourself?
Yeah, no, I don't think I would. I think it's I don't think I've got the skill set. I think when I was a teenager, I was very keen on the idea of like acting and entertainment and those kind of things. But I kind of soon came to see that actually that life probably wasn't for me, and I was more about kind of words.
And one thing we'll miss if we download the audio version of the book is the cover. Can you give us a little description of it?
Yeah, it's a great cover. It's sort of a picture of a woman looking into a mirror. So you can see a blurred version of her face, and then you can just see this portion of her face in like a round hand mirror. So you can just see her eye and her nose, and she's quite sinister looking. You really wouldn't mess with her. It's got the word sick to death in kind of a really vivid, bold, kind of pink neon letters that pop on a kind of like bluey purple background. And it's got the tagline, it says, "Sick to death. Emma is sick, just not in the way you think."
I walk away, my eyes averted, making a steady exit. I resist the urge to run at him and make his skull ricochet off the wall. To hear the exquisite crumpling of bones and flesh as he falls to the floor and watch him flail around helplessly before me. I don't think that I'm alone in having these thoughts. The fantasies that inhabit our subconscious. The daydream of punching an obnoxious colleague in the face. That idle thought of how satisfying it would be to push a troublesome family member to the ground, to sink a knife into the ribs of a tyrannical politician. There's no refuge, he saw to that. Along with my father, all traces of me have been eradicated from this place, too. My bedroom had been picked bare, scrubbed, painted, and recarpeted to DIY shop blandness. The few belongings I have are all hidden in the garage where I won't go. My clothes now crammed in a wardrobe that I share with Ava. For a bed, I have the faded settee once everyone has gone to sleep. My old bedroom is now his office with grey filing cabinets and a desk wedged in. It was a temporary arrangement, deemed essential during the first wave of the virus, that hideous and claustrophobic time. It didn't end, though. I've given up asking Mum when I can have my room back. I should move out, but I have no money for a flat, and I figure I'm way down on the housing priority lists, even with my neurological condition. After all, I have a safe space with my family, don't I? There's nothing to harm me here. Or at least, that's what people would think.
Sick to Death by Chris Bridges is available now in print as an ebook and in audio, as read by Karina Fernandez, Annie Adlington, Helen Colby and Georgie Wyatt. And Chris, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I've been involved in the talking book service for a long time, since I was just starting out as an actor.
Julian Fellows on supporting talking books.
I suppose what draws me to it is that my whole life has been based around the word, you know, as an actor and then a screenwriter and a novelist and everything else, and the thought of being deprived of the word is terrifying to me. But also what is really crucial to the Talking Book Service is it makes blind people autonomous. You want to get back some of the pleasures that you knew before, and the one that can come back 100% unqualified is reading a book, and that is because of the Talking Book Service.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now on Read On, let's take our second visit to the RNIB Talking Book Studios.
This science fiction story, Foe, by Ian Reid, was recently made into a film. It was given to us by Simon & Schuster.
I hear Hen walk down the stairs and into the room. I turn around. She must have just gotten out of the shower. She's in cut-off shorts and a black tank top. Her hair is damp. She looks beautiful. Truly. I don't think she could look more like herself or any better than she does right now, like this. Hello, I say. Hey. Neither of us says anything else for a moment, until she breaks the silence. I didn't know you were here. Inside, I mean. I thought you were still out in the barn. She brings her hand up to her hair, playing with it in a specific way, curling it slowly around her index finger and then straightening the hair out. It's compulsive. She does this when she's concentrating, or when she's agitated. Someone's here, I say again. She stands there, staring at me. I don't think she's blinked. Her posture is stiff, reserved. What? I ask. What is it? Are you okay? Yes, she replies. It's nothing. I'm surprised someone's here.
Long married couple, Junior and Henrietta, live a quiet, solitary life on their farm, where they work at the local feed mill and raise chickens. Their lives are simple, until the day a stranger arrives at their door with alarming news. Junior has been chosen to take a journey across both time and distance, while Hen remains at home. Junior will be gone for years, but Hen won't be left alone. As the time for his departure draws nearer, Junior finds himself questioning everything about his life, even whether it's really his life at all.
She takes a few hesitant steps towards me. She maintains more than an arm's length distance, but is close enough now that I smell her hand cream. Coconut and something else. Mint, I think. It's a unique smell, and one I register as Hen. Do you know anyone with a black car like that? No, I say. Looks official, like government, doesn't it? Could be, she says. The windows are tinted. I can't see inside. He must want something, whoever it is. They're here. They came all the way up to the house. A car door finally opens, but no one steps out. At least not right away. We wait. It feels like 5 minutes, standing, watching, waiting to see who will step out of the car. But maybe it's more like 20 seconds. Then I see a leg. Someone steps out. It's a man. He has long blonde hair. He's wearing a dark suit, collared shirt, open at the top, no tie. He has a black briefcase with him. He shuts the car door, adjusts his jacket, and walks up to the front porch. I hear him on the old wooden planks. He doesn't need to knock on the door because we're watching and he can see us through the window. And we know he's here, but we wait and watch anyhow, and eventually the knock comes. "You answer it," I say, buttoning a section of middle buttons on my shirt. Hen doesn't reply, but turns and walks out of the living room, goes to the front door. She delays, looks back at me, turns, takes a breath, and then she opens the door. "Hello," she says. "Hi there, sorry to disturb you at this hour," the man replies. "I hope it's okay. Henrietta, right?" She nods and looks down at her feet. "My name is Terence. I'd like to have a word with you, inside if possible. Is your husband home?" The man's exaggerated smile hasn't changed since she opened the door, not at all. "What's this about?" I ask, stepping out of the living room into the hall. I'm right behind Hen. I place a hand on her shoulder. She flinches at my touch. The man turns his attention to me. I'm taller than he is, wider, and older by a few years. Our eyes meet. He holds his attention on me for several moments, longer than what I deem normal. His smile moves to his eyes as if he's delighted by what he sees. "Junior, right?" "Sorry, do we know you?" "You look great." "What's that?" "This is very exciting." He looks to Hen. She doesn't look at him. I had butterflies in my stomach the whole way over, and it's not a short drive from the city. "It's thrilling to finally see you like this. I'm here to talk with you, both of you. That's all," he says. "Just to talk. I think you'll want to hear what I have to say."
Foe by Ian Reid is read by Jacques Roy and runs for 5 hours and 32 minutes.
We have Hope, written by Pope Francis. It was given to us by Penguin Random House.
"Finally, they left. My grandparents managed to sell their few possessions in the Piedmont countryside and traveled to the port of Genoa to sail on the SS Giulio Cesare with a one-way ticket. They waited for boarding operations for the first-class passengers to be completed, and then at last for their turn to arrive for the third class. When the ship reached the open sea and the last beams of the lighthouse, the old Lanterna, vanished from the horizon, they knew they would never see Italy again and would have to begin their lives anew on the other side of the world. It was February 1st, 1929, during one of the coldest winters the century would ever know. The thermometer in Turin reached negative 15 degrees Celsius, and even negative 25 in other parts of Italy. It was what Federico Fellini remembered in his film Amarcord as the winter of the great snow. The whole of Europe was covered by a heavy blanket, from the Ural Mountains to the coasts of the Mediterranean, and even the Dome of St. Peter's was plentifully white.
Hope is the first autobiography in history ever to be published by a pope. Written over 6 years, this complete autobiography starts in the early years of the 20th century with Pope Francis's Italian roots and his ancestors' courageous migration to Latin America, continuing through his childhood, the enthusiasm and preoccupations of his youth, his vocation, adult life, and the whole of his papacy up to the present day.
When the steamship finally reached Buenos Aires after its two-week voyage, with stopovers at the ports of Villefranche-sur-Mer, Barcelona, Rio de Janeiro, Santos, and Montevideo, my grandmother Rosa was still wearing the lovely coat in which she left, despite the humid heat that touched 30 degrees Celsius. She had decorated it with a fox fur collar, as was the custom, and had stitched all that they owned, everything of value, into the inner lining between the skin and the silk. She continued wearing it almost like a uniform, even after they had left the ship as they traveled inland, sailing wearily up the Paraná River for another 300 miles until they reached their destination. Only then did the luchadora, the wrestler, as she would come to be known, decide that she could lower her guard. At the port of arrival, all three were registered as migrantes ultramar. My grandfather, Nonno Giovanni, who, after laboring as a sharecropper, had opened a coffee and pastry shop, was described as comercio, trader, his wife Rosa as casera, housewife, and their son Mario, my father, who, to the great satisfaction of his parents, had gained a commercial school diploma as contador, bookkeeper.
Hope, by Pope Francis, is narrated by Peter Gannam and runs for 12 hours and 42 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Chris Bridges for the books of his life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh my gosh, so many. I love being asked about books. This is one of my favourite things. You might not be able to shut me up. And I'm known among my friends as being a book recommender. So people message me for asking for recommendations. So yeah, I mean, I think as a child, I did the usual stuff. So I think I was this 1970s child. So I used to read these, the Enid Blyton and all of those things. But I think at the age of about 10, there was a book that really consumed me. And that was Map and Lucia by E.F. Benson. So they're books set in the 1920s and 30s. And they're set in a fictional small seaside town in Sussex, which is loosely based on the town of Rye. And it's about a woman called Lucia who's widowed, and she goes to this town, rents a house to holiday, and she sets in motion this whole chain of bitchy, catty one-upmanship between her and a woman called Map. So the two of them, Map and Lucia, they're kind of a constant cycle of one-upmanship to see who can be the best. And it's a kind of quite a old-fashioned camp kind of book. It's all sort of bridge parties, awful soirees and village fates. I did have a listen to the audiobook and it sounded really good because it's actually narrated by Miriam Margolyes, who's always good value. So there are a series of books, I think there's six of them, and they really, really captured me. I don't know if it was the kind of one-upmanship and the fighting and this kind of fight to be the dominant woman. I remember finding that really entertaining.
One morning, about the middle of October, Lucia was seated at breakfast, frowning over a note which she had just received. It began without any formality and was written in pencil. Do look in about 9:30 on Saturday and be silly for an hour or two. We'll play games and dance, shall we? Bring your husband, of course, and don't bother to reply. Signed, O.B. An invitation, she said icily as she passed it to her husband. Rather short notice. Well, we're not doing anything, are we? He asked. Peppino was a little imperceptive sometimes. No, it wasn't that I meant, she said. But there's a little more informality about it than one would expect. Probably it's an informal party, said he. It certainly seems most informal. I'm not accustomed to be asked quite like that. Peppino began to be aware of the true nature of the situation. I see what you mean, Cara, he said. So don't let us go. She will take the hint, perhaps. Lucia thought this over for a moment and found that she rather wanted to go. But a certain resentment that had been slowly accumulating in her mind for some days past began to leak out before she consented to overlook Olga's informality. It is a fortnight since I called on her, she said, and she has not even returned the call. I dare say they behave like that in London in certain circles, but I don't know that London is any better for it. She has been away twice since she came, said Peppino. She's hardly been here for a couple of days together yet. I may be wrong, said Lucia. No doubt I am wrong. But I should have thought that she might have spared 30 minutes out of those days in returning my call. However, she thought not. Peppino suddenly recollected a thrilling piece of news, which, most unaccountably, he had forgotten to tell Lucia. "Oh, dear me, something slipped my memory," he said. "I met Mrs. Weston yesterday afternoon, who told me that Miss Braceley had seen her in her bath chair and had taken the handles from Tommy Luton and pushed her twice round the green, positively running."
As Chris said, the commercial versions of the Map and Lucia books are available as narrated by Maria Margulies. What you heard there, though, was William Abney reading from Queen Lucia, the first book in the series, which is available from RNIB Talking Books. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
So there's a book I've read many, many times, and that's Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. I could read that again and again. Either that or Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. They're my two favourite reads. They're like a comfort read. I feel like I'm stepping into a warm bath or a sort of afternoon with a friend. Rebecca particularly, I think it's got this whole atmospheric thing about the young woman who marries this mysterious man and she doesn't quite understand what's going on. She's whisked back to his Cornish mansion and there's this kind of dark secret there about his first wife. Such an iconic and clever book. I had quite a strange experience the first time I read that because I'd borrowed it from the local library and I was very hooked on the book and the action and to see what the ending was and whether there was a twist or what it was all about. I got to the end and the last chapter was missing. Somebody had ripped the book and there were pages missing. So I had to quickly leg it into the city centre from the suburb where we lived to go and buy a copy so I could find out what actually happened. And then I sat on a wall and read the ending. It was quite disastrous, but yeah, I got there in the end.
Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. It seemed to me I stood by the iron gate leading to the drive, and for a while I could not enter, for the way was barred to me. There was a padlock and a chain upon the gate. I called in my dream to the lodgekeeper and had no answer, and peering closer through the rusted spokes of the gate, I saw that the lodge was uninhabited. No smoke came from the chimney, and the little lattice windows gaped forlorn. Then, like all dreamers, I was possessed of a sudden with supernatural powers, and passed like a spirit through the barrier before me. The drive wound away in front of me, twisting and turning as it had always done, but as I advanced, I was aware that a change had come upon it. It was narrow and unkept, not the drive that we had known. At first I was puzzled and did not understand, and it was only when I bent my head to avoid the low-swinging branch of a tree that I realised what had happened. Nature had come into her own again, and little by little, in her stealthy, insidious way, had encroached upon the drive with long, tenacious fingers.
That's Junita Jimenez reading from Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but some you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
So there's a book that I read quite recently and it actually made my heart pound. It was kind of a book I was holding my breath, dry mouthed. It was like I was actually living this situation. And it's a book called Night Watching by Tracy Sierra. It's an American novel. It's about a woman who's in a remote house in backwoods America. And she's there with her two children at night. She gets up, goes into the little boy's bedroom because he makes a noise. And as she turns around, she hears a noise on the stairs, looks round, and there's a man standing on the stairs looking at her, a stranger. He can't see her because there's a nightlight at skirting board level that's shining into his eyes. So she's got this moment where she needs to grab the children and get away. And it's a really high octane book. It just doesn't let up at all. But equally, it's got some quite important issues and it's very clever with characterization. And there's issues about the characters that sort of you find out later on. It's quite a nuanced and clever book with a lot of layers. I'd recommend it to everyone and I have recommended it a lot.
There was someone in the house. She stood in her son's dark bedroom, through its open door and down the long hallway,
The landing at the top of the steep kitchen stairs was lit by the dim glow of a plug-in nightlight. The light was there so the children would be able to see the stairs in their nighttime wanderings, to prevent them silently, helplessly falling as they padded from their rooms to their parents' bedroom overnight, seeking water or comfort or after a wet bed. The old house let the wind hiss through and crack its ribs, the sounds of it bracing against the storm. Its staggered breathing were familiar, but through it all came noises that rooted her to the spot. Also familiar, but not at this time of night. Not when she had been sure she was the only one awake. In the brief hush between the frozen gusts came the wheeze of weight on the stairs. You're imagining things. Her daughter lay asleep in the next room. Her son was already sleeping again a few steps away from her. For a moment, the hope that it might be her husband lifted her. Stop it, that's impossible. But it could be her daughter sleepwalking again. They'd bolted the door of the girl's room that led to the old front stairs, a place too dangerous to let her sightlessly wander. But it was possible her daughter had gone out the other door to her bedroom. The one they left unlocked despite the girl's sleepwalking and the danger of the kitchen stairs. The door they left open so she could use the bathroom at night, so that she understood she was still a big girl, they trusted her, and she should trust herself. Yes, that could explain it, and you wouldn't have heard the baby monitor go on.
That's Emily Ellis reading from Night Watching by Tracy Sierra, available from RNIB Talking Books. And once again, Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you again. Yeah, it's been great. Thanks a lot.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.